Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 105, we're co-anchoring from St. Moritz and London,
where we'll be debating if broadcasters fail to prepare audiences for the recent Arab Spring uprisings.
The fact that British audiences, at least, simply don't have the opportunity to get a deep understanding of most countries in the Middle East. So when something like the Arab Spring happens, they're just not in a position to have the depth of understanding that they should.
That was Martin Scott from the University of East Anglia.
And we'll also be finding out the headlines from this week's Paris Air Show.
I think it's probably been a far more exciting Paris than people had expected. I mean, the number of orders that have come through, I mean, we're talking of over 1,000 aeroplanes altogether. You know, when you see those kind of figures, you can see that we're in that part of the curve where things are improving again.
That was Eddie Pieniezek, Director of Aviation Consultancy, Ascend.
And later in the programme, we'll be talking to Monocle's Creative Director, Richard Spencer Powell, about the future of illustration as London prepares to host the inaugural Book Illustration Awards.
It's interesting that over the last 10 years, there's been a sort of a shift from people doing digital work, and there's been a return to craft, a return to using hand-cut paper, to doing woodcuts, to doing mixed media. And these awards are also about original artwork.
And now, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, June 26, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly with me, Tyler Brulé, coming to you from St. Moritz in the heart of the Engadine Valley in Switzerland. And over in London, who do we have?
It's the same old twosome, the gruesome twosome.
Mr. Tuck and Mr. Bound.
How are you, gentlemen?
We're all right, actually. We've had a quiet week without you.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I mean, we've been out. We've been down the pub.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a very sort of long time no see anyway. I just saw you on. I think by the time we left, it was actually already this week. It was Monday morning when we parted ways in the lobby of the Park Hyatt in Milan.
Yes, we were all there for the menswear shows, although we didn't get to see the shows. We kind of got more meet the companies.
The men's shows came to us, though, didn't they?
Yes, we had a very nice party on the Sunday night for 200 people in Milan. And we got to meet lots of people we like, including the man I always like, just because his business card is good, Pogeymaster X, which is a very good name to have on a business card.
Pogeymaster X from United Arrows, who always has the best sideburns as well. He gives new meaning to Japanese mutton chops.
I think he should have that down the side of his card so that you can always remember who he is. Should have sort of furry strips down the side of his card. That'd be nice.
That's only because I know that I've seen you when you get business cards. You do write on the back little kind of notes to remember who the people are.
Yeah, exactly. You hope they never see them.
But Andrew, you didn't spy anything for your wardrobe for next summer?
Actually, I then spent all of Monday going around seeing lots of different companies, and it was actually great to see the full collections in studio. And it was also really interesting going from one to the next. So, you know, a company that's actually kind of pushing red or, you know, bright colours for next year, then you suddenly went to someone who's completely taupe in their kind of vision of what the world should be.
And you think they've made the wrong left turn at that point.
Yes, but it was just good. The other funny thing about Milan is I'm always amazed that what a kind of maid culture still exists. So every time you go to a company, there's a maid in a pinny serving great espresso. Or when you go to the lobby of a building, there's a guy whose job is still to sit there and kind of check everybody who comes in and out. There's a real kind of old-fashioned service culture that exists in Milan.
Yeah, it's alive and well. I guess there's pockets of it still in Spain, but it is remarkable. And you're right, and very, very good uniforms at most companies as well.
Yes, I guess if you're working for a fashion company, you hope you can run up something simple for your maid as well.
No, but they're all the same, though. The gentlemen are always in nice Mandarin collar jackets with the gold buttons, and yes. and the ladies, yeah, as you said, always in nice pinnies.
And a chin strap as well, like a sort of pillbox hat with a chin strap.
But I did.
Why would they have a chin strap, Rob?
I don't know. Sometimes it's windy.
But you got to do a bit of a city tour, because I did see a picture of you with a very small pony.
Me?
Yeah. No, Rob.
Yeah, that's Rob. Right. The day after the party, we went for a walk in the park where some of the shows were, in that sort of palazzo building. Found a little group of Shetland ponies randomly. Like
that palazzo building in Milan. Like, yeah. As if there's only one.
Yes, exactly. Well, the one that's in the park. You know, the one. And yes, and there were sort of weird sort of little collection of Shetland ponies. Obviously, that got uploaded to the internet with the witty caption from Emily Smith, our PR manager, Italian Stallion.
Oh, there we are.
Yeah. Okay. So yes, we had a nice time, and then off you went to the Engadine Valley for I don't know how much you want to reveal of what we've been having done in the Engadine Valley.
For my knee op, yes, I left you because I was supposed to stop drinking at 10 o'clock, but I think I stopped drinking at about 12, and then I was I think I got up to Samaritz at about, I don't know, it was sometime after 9 o'clock. I was told I needed to report to the clinic good by 10 o'clock. And I was at the clinic by about 1:45, and I was in a gown before you knew. But there was a whole new innovation this time, because last time, gown was the same, nice pleat down the front, same robe, same slippers. But then they said I couldn't wear my normal underpants.
That's exposing your Engadin Valley, presumably.
So I had to deposit my nice sunspell somewhere, and they gave me these awful paper pants.
Well, not again, not paper.
I know. Yeah, anyway.
You weren't near any naked flames, were you? They're not involved in the operation.
But the good thing is that Zimmer Nummer Swolf at the Klinik Gut has a very nice terrace, has very nice Garpa outdoor furniture. It had a very nice Sonnenraum, I think you'd probably call it. And so it was good. So I had about an hour pre-surgery just to sit out in the sunshine.
So we have to trust you that it's actually your knee. You're not going to come back with a very tight forehead and pulled up jowls, are you?
And new lips, so they've got to move the microphone back a foot.
My, haven't you grown?
Yeah, exactly. You were going to say, it's like, just did it really take 2 weeks to do your knee? No. So I was there for 2 days, but there was quite a remarkable negotiation that had to happen with the nurse, because the last time when I had my other knee done 2 years ago, and it's just a meniscus operation, it's not a whole new kneecap, but that nurse, you know, she just shaved around my knee, and then this rather buxom nurse, she pulled out a new set of shears, and so we had this very long negotiation about how much of my leg she was going to shave. And so she threatened to shave the whole thing. And I said, it's summertime. You can't do that. I said, I wouldn't really care if it was wintertime. And anyway, we sort of compromised on sort of half-half. And you'll notice when we get back and if the sun comes out, London, I'm wearing shorts.
Did she carve a monocle M into your hair as well?
I think she might have done it on the back of my thigh. Anyway, the whole thing took 40 minutes. I came to, because they do ask, and it said there's a monitor above the table. Do you want to watch? No, thank you. I would like some more drugs. And and that was it. Anyway, 2 days in the hospital, out. Here I am in the very nice studio of Radio Engadin, which is, I guess, headquartered in Coor, but this is their, actually, and I'm lying. Samaritz is sort of geographically sort of the broader area of where we are, but I'm actually in Samaten, beside the airport, next to I think it's a butcher shop, in fact, where the studios are. But it's very nice. There's views of the mountains. It's lovely.
And just to remind you of your operation at all times.
Exactly.
And they broadcast in what language?
They broadcast in German, and I think there's some programming in Romansh. And so maybe we can do a simulcast later.
Very good. Well, Rob's Romansh is quite good.
I'm looking at the script that they sent me. It says that we're supposed to talk about Greece, but I don't think we have so much to say about Greece. I mean, it's all been said earlier in the week, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure we've got much to add after your leg.
No, the only thing I was going to say, though, I think some of the best news about Greece is Alexios, my new assistant, Alex Matthews, my former assistant, just moved back to Cape Town. And now Alexios Lepoulos is my new assistant, and I think he should go around the country because he's so bloody efficient.
Well, the good thing is he won't be running home anytime soon, isn't he? He's going to be dependable in London.
You said that like a Greek person would say it. He's not going to go home anytime soon, isn't he? That was good. That was good. That was good. A little off colour as a joke, Andrew, frankly.
Okay.
All right. But maybe, Andrew, we were talking earlier in the week, because we've got Monocle Mediterranean coming up. So we might be looking for some type of solution-driven feature on Greece, perhaps, right?
Yes. Well, actually, between you and me and our listeners, I have actually prepared to dispatch someone to Athens at the end of this week to do a report on actually a couple of more interesting things that are going on there than other than the doom and gloom. There's actually quite a good story to be told about Athens.
And is that more along, without giving it away, but do you think it's more along the lines that this is a country which continues to function despite itself? And I mean, we often have that discussion about Italy, but I think Greece is a little bit different.
Yeah, what's funny is that even now there are people with big ambitions who actually are seeing this as a moment of opportunity, with actually prices down for property, a very slow real estate market, that actually maybe you could do some things a little bit more authentic, a little bit more Greek orientated, not kind of just trying to make an international buck. And yeah, so we found some very interesting people to go meet at the end of the week.
And that's just not the Chinese trying to snatch up all the ports.
These are Greek people. These are proper Greek people. Pom-poms and their shoes and everything.
And not people from the Near East as well, jumping across the Med to launch any raids.
No. Although we're going to have another Levantine guest in later on, so maybe she's got her pockets full of cash ready to eye up Greece.
Yes, because we're going to be talking a little bit about, I guess the state of broadcasters and how it's been for everybody else who's... And I feel so sorry for a lot of the correspondents who maybe had sort of a good time of it, certainly early days of the uprising, early spring across the Middle East and North Africa. But it's getting a little hot if you're someone like Jeffrey Kaufman from ABC News on a rooftop in Tripoli at the moment.
Well, I think he's been getting a pretty good tan up there, but it's getting pretty hot up there. But from the safety of the UK, a new report out this week by the International Broadcasting Trust and the University of East Anglia claims that broadcasters fail to prepare audiences for the Arab Spring. The report analyses all non-news factual coverage on UK television in 2010 and finds that 5 out of the 12 countries which have recently experienced revolutions and uprisings were not the subject of any programme on UK television. Joining us now on the line to tell us more is the author of the report, Martin Scott, of East Anglia University. Hi, Martin.
Hi there.
So the headline of the report is Broadcasters Failed to Prepare Audiences for the Arab Spring. It sounds like someone doesn't care. Is it the broadcasters or is it the viewers?
Oh, okay. Excellent question. I think it's a broadcaster's assumptions about the audience and to some extent the audience, but I think it's a bit of a vicious cycle between the two. But I don't think it's anything new. It's North Africa and the Middle East haven't appeared, as far as our research shows, to any great degree ever in UK broadcasting. I think the point about the Arab Spring is that it shows why it's important that they should.
And the specificity of the report is non-news factual coverage. It's kind of an important distinction to make. Is there an argument to say that there is so much of the Middle East in the news that regular factual programming can skip over it?
No, I think completely the opposite. So if you're suggesting that if the news covers some parts of North Africa and the Middle East, therefore non-news factual programming doesn't need to, then, well, I think the purpose of non-news factual programming is to provide that wider context for people to understand what's going on in the news, the sort of context that you don't get in 2 or 3 minutes. So I can illustrate the point, because I think it's useful to hear the details of it. You're right, in this study at least, we didn't look at news programming. We look at everything outside news programming. And in 2010, on UK television, on the 9 biggest channels, overall, North Africa and the Middle East received 5% of all international factual programming, which, as I say, is no surprise. They received 5% of all coverage for the last several years. What is interesting is which countries get covered. Of that 5%, the vast majority was either Israel or Iraq. Outside of those countries, Egypt received some coverage. What's most interesting and what we highlight in the report is those countries that didn't receive any coverage. So on non-news factual programming in 2010 in the UK, the following countries simply received no coverage. Algeria, Bahrain, Lebanon, Libya, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Yemen. And if you look at events now and look at that list and the thought that Libya, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Yemen received zero coverage outside of the news last year. On top of that, Tunisia was covered in one cookery program, and so was Morocco, and Syria was covered in just one program as well. So I think it's highlighting the fact that British audiences, at least, simply don't have the opportunity to get a deep understanding of most countries in the Middle East. So when something like the Arab Spring happens, they're just not in a position to have the depth of understanding that they should.
And where does this stem from? I mean, is this because, I mean, factual programming is a funny animal. It includes things like Big Brother, sort of famously. But I mean, is this because there aren't enough sort of property shows in the Sun coming from the Middle East? Or is it a deeper-seated thing? And did you notice a difference between commercial channels and state broadcasts of the BBC, for example?
Well, I think the point is that there's no programming, so it's not just that there's not enough travel commercial programmes about the Middle East. There's no factual programmes either, and there's no current affairs programmes about them either, apart from Israel and Iraq. So it's not a matter of genre, it's a matter of complete absence. When the Middle East did appear, it is generally on the public service broadcasters rather than commercial, but it's a hard distinction to make because it's simply not there on either of them. There is a wider distinction between public service and commercial channels in the UK, and which is reflective of a wider point about the report in general. Overall, we find that international factual programming has declined by 40% over the last 5 years on these 9 channels, 40% since 2005, and that's seen declines on all the main channels channels in the UK, apart from Channel 4, which does have a public service commitment to this sort of programming, particularly in news. But strikingly, the BBC, in 2010, BBC One, the biggest channel on UK television that audiences watch, had just 16 hours of factual programming about developing countries, even less than virtually every other channel in our sample. And there's a wider point about not just North Africa and the Middle East, but just large parts of the global south simply not appearing on our big public service broadcasters in the UK. And the other point is that the programming is sometimes there, but it's shifted from our big public service broadcasting channels, BBC One and BBC Two, to the digital channels, BBC Three and BBC Four, which have seen increases in programming about the south. But those channels get far smaller audiences. So while the BBC's response to this report is that overall levels of international factual programming from the BBC have remained the same, which is true, there's been a big shift away from the BBC One and BBC Two onto digital channels, which have much lower audiences.
OK, Martin, and just one final question to close up. What would you expect non-news factual programming to teach its viewers? Is it about spotting undercurrents in the politics, the culture, the religious differences in these countries? Is that the sort of thing that you'd be expecting programmes to tell us?
What am I expecting? Good question. I think non-news factual programming has got a lot of different kinds of purposes. It should be doing lots of different things, providing context that the news doesn't often have the capacity to do, providing us with an indication of normality and real life in these countries. The one program that was about Syria was a very good program called Syrian School, which is a fly-on-the-wall documentary about normal children going to school in Syria. And there have been various series about this. But this kind of programming does a very good job of showing British audiences that people in Syria are normal people who go to school and have children and have normal lives. So that's I guess, another purpose of non-news factual programming. But I guess we can debate about what function it should be serving. But the results of the report say that, well, it's at the moment, is not serving any function at all.
It does sound like certain parts of the world have been sort of wiped off the TV map. Martin Scott, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Stop. Now here in the London studio is our Beirut correspondent, Carol Corm. Welcome, Carol.
Hi.
What do you think of Martin Scott's report? Is that something, obviously, coming between London and Beirut yourself, do you notice such a big difference between the sort of programming schedules and the amount of focus given to the region?
I think it's very interesting, but if we turned the table to the Middle East, I'd say we don't watch that many programs about Europe or Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and we probably would have a smaller percentage devoted to those places. We have also like huge cliches on Europe and America, so I guess we're not in a good position to talk. But that said, Al Jazeera is doing a great job with their documentaries are really, really good. More people should watch them. Aside from that, whether the British audience was prepared or not because it didn't watch enough programs on the Middle East, I mean, maybe we all need masters on Middle Eastern politics to understand because even the biggest experts didn't see it coming. So I don't think we can draw a link saying because people didn't have enough background, they didn't see it coming.
Tyler, I wanted to ask you whether, you know, it's a good opportunity to channel hop this week. I wonder what you thought watching the programming out of the middle of Europe, whether you noticed people kind of jumping on the bandwagon now the Middle East become so interesting.
Well, it's interesting as well, because standing back and not sitting in London at the moment, it's just, I'm wondering also if this is just another one of these reports that, you know, yet another body generates in the UK, which is just, you know, it's an outrage piece that, oh, you know, look what happened. But I think, you know, as Carol was saying, you know, had there been, you know, a cookery show, if our good friend Kamal, you know, had a Syrian cooking program, would it have prepared us, you know, any more for what the Assad family is up to? I'm not sure. You know, had there been a travel show, you know, from Libya, I sort of wonder, you know, what would these, you know, these non-news factual programs actually do? You know, I'm quite convinced that, you know, people who go to school in Syria are quite normal. I'm not sure about you.
Yeah, there was that. It was interesting, the idea of Syrian school, the idea of normality, and also almost the idea of kind of being able to watch kind of silly, glittery curtain game shows kind of gives you an understanding of the culture in a strangely similar way than knowing the politics of a place.
Maybe we should have the Arab version of Pop Idol in the UK, because it's very amusing. It's pan-Arab. You have someone from every country in the Middle East.
And but I was sort of, yeah, because I was also sort of listening, thinking, you know, was it ever thus? I mean, you know, if we you know, rewound, you know, the clocks, you know, 20 odd years ago, and it was, you know, let's say it was 1989, or we were doing this program in 1990. I wonder what your hair would be like in 1990, Rob. That's a question.
Not dissimilar from what he's got today, actually.
Steady on.
No, but would we be saying the same things? Oh, you know, were we prepared? Were there enough programs about Czechoslovakia? Were there enough programs about Yugoslavia? Were we prepared in that way? And I think we'd be having a not dissimilar discussion.
I think the question about the Arab coverage, you know, you're completely right. But the interesting thing is it does log the total number of hours on UK TV that are dedicated to international coverage. And you see this chart going down year upon year upon year, and I think there is a concern that you could end up, you know, when you're in the States and you turn on American television, and you know, it's very hard to believe that there is another country in the world other than the United States, because their remit has become just domestic coverage. And I wonder whether, as budgets get cut and TV stations are trying to look to save money, whether there'll be increased pressure to kind of, you know, not send people out on anything other than news reporting. So, you know, of course, if something happens in Japan with the earthquake, or there's the war in Libya, you cover it, but you just never find the time or the budget to do other stories.
But let's be objective also. I mean, people are so overloaded with news from the Middle East. Do they really want to watch a program about favelas in Egypt or food shortages in Tunisia? They're not interested. So,
well, there's always the sense of the backstory. That's always what we don't get on a half an hour news bulletin, especially when there's 7 minutes for the lead story, or a maximum of 7 minutes for the lead story. It's always good to know the backstory of these things, where this thing started always. And that's I suppose is the idea of these non-news factual programmings, give you context.
But if you're the CEO of one of the, you know, private networks, or you're the director general of the BBC, aren't you saying, well, fine, but that is why we created, you know, BBC4, or someone says, you know, that's why there are, you know, 25 different versions of the Discovery Channel. That's why we have these outlets, and the main broadcasters are supposed to pander to the masses.
Yeah, it's also interesting how you have to package. You know, when it was quite interesting looking at the list of programs that were fitted into his category. You know, there were lots of kind of slightly faded kind of British TV hosts who had been sent off around the world to do bits of reporting, and that was kind of the only way in which you could really make places digestible. You needed to send you someone like Joanna Lumley up the Nile on a boat or something. That suddenly then people would be entranced by it. But it was very hard to kind of, as Carol says, there's a kind of a reputation for foreign coverage in this realm to be slightly dull and boring. I think it's actually quite hard for the program makers to actually think quite creatively about what would be an interesting kind of fun program about somewhere that's not out, not in the UK or
Yeah,
Europe.
It's become an apocryphal tale of the BBC commissioner who, you know, you want to do an interesting program about the Etruscans, but you can only really do a program about the Etruscans if the pub landlord fronts the program about the Etruscans, and then it's actually about the pub landlord rather than the Etruscans. That's always the problem.
Sorry, from a Middle Eastern point of view, I'd say we tend to criticize when there are programs we find they're often slightly orientalist. It's about the women and the veil and sexuality and women in Saudi Arabia or transsexuals in Egypt. It's always kind of focusing on the same stories, which from an Arab point of view is a little bit annoying.
Andrew, I think that you should send Rob to do that story on trannies in Egypt.
He'd had to ask once or twice before, but you know,
you keep spiking his research.
I'm ready to pack my suitcase. I just don't know what to wear.
Carol, while we have you in London, I'm wondering. You know, it seems like every year we always ask you. You know, how is the summer shaping up in Lebanon? And I mean, given you know, all events across the border, you know, is all money on Beirut at the moment, or you know, how do things look to you?
Well, I'm secretly hoping that Lebanon will become this safe haven where all the people fleeing from other Arab countries will come and summer in Beirut. But I don't think it's going to be like that.
Because one thing that I've been wondering, and this goes back to a coverage issue, and you know, you see a lot of correspondents who are, of course, up on the border in Turkey, and we see, you know, refugee camps. And I'm wondering, you know, whether it's moneyed or middle class or poor Syrians, are they fleeing into Lebanon? Well, what's happening on the borders in Lebanon?
I've noticed the border is relatively calm from the Beirut side, but the northern Lebanese Syrian borders is a little bit heated, but nothing like Turkey. That said, in Beirut, there's a lot more Syrian cars with Syrian plates driving around. And there are a few more Syrians than we've seen in the past 5-6 years. definitely there are more kind of waiting it out in Beirut.
It is interesting whether, as you're saying, that this Switzerland status, you know, could quite easily, emerge almost by default in a way.
We wish, but I don't think so. I think if the problems continue in Syria, it'll probably spill over in Lebanon. The Lebanese right now are just pretending there's no issue. No one's talking about Syria. Everyone's kind of focused on the new government, which we just had last week, and the tribunal for the Hariri case. And everyone's kind of avoiding the pink elephant in the room, which is the situation in Syria.
And not the tranny from Egypt.
We'll leave that for the BBC.
Sounds like I better pack my suitcase. Carol, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly from St Moritz in London. We're back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. Well, this weekend, the 49th International Paris Air Show at Le Bourget draws to a close, having attracted 2,100 international exhibitors, 340,000 visitors, and a flood of Airbus 320neo orders. Eddie Pienzek, director of aviation consultancy Ascend, was at the show and joins us on the line from London to tell us more. Hello, Eddie.
Hello.
I guess, who is the real show stealer, if we're talking about airlines first? Is it a toss-up between orders that we saw coming out of Malaysia, or was it India?
It's been a mix of things. I mean, in terms of capturing the headlines, it's definitely AirAsia and the Indian carriers stealing the thunder in terms of the orders for the Airbus A320neo. There have been some orders from the Middle East, as we might expect as well. And we've also seen a bit of interest from Latin America. So it's all those emerging and growing markets that have sort of built up their presence probably over the last decade or so.
Just for the layperson who maybe is not following the latest developments in terms of what's happening at Boeing or Airbus, we all know what an Airbus A320 is. But is the A320neo, is that just an A320 with bigger, taller winglets?
The Neo is probably the biggest differential on the Neo is the fact that it's featuring a new generation of engines. These are engines which are delivering 15% better fuel efficiency, lower emissions, you know, just much more efficient and geared towards helping the airlines generate the kind of profits they need. So this is an existing model in terms of the Airbus A320 that's been around for over 20 years now, but it's getting this update. The engines are delivering a lot of the efficiency, but it's also getting a new type of winglet for the wings as well, and it's just a general upgrade package. But it's proving to be very attractive to the airlines at the moment.
For the traveling public, though, will they really notice anything different when they board the aircraft?
In terms of boarding the aircraft, probably nothing that they wouldn't normally expect anyway. I mean, as aircraft development programs develop, they will see improvements in terms of the interiors and the seating, the lighting and those kind of functions. Probably the best place where they might see some improvements might be in the fact that the ticket prices remain affordable because the aircraft are that much more efficient and those savings can be passed on to the passengers. So I think that's where the passenger will see most of the improvements.
Or the passenger will hope by the time those aircraft are delivered. We always sort of stack up the numbers as to who is the winner, and it's always, you know, it is always an Airbus versus Boeing match. Who did emerge as the winner in terms of total numbers in the commercial aviation sector then?
Well, if you're looking at total numbers over the years, you've probably seen pretty much a 50-50 battle between Airbus and Boeing in terms of the orders they capture each year. This particular occasion, Airbus has swamped the market with orders. I think in terms of the total number of firm orders, of options, of commitments, letters of intent, you know, we must be closing on about 1,000 airplanes as far as Airbus is concerned. This is in terms of the deals that they've announced at the show or deals that had been announced previously but have just been firmed up during the course of the show or announced at the show. So that whole package, Airbus have really stolen a march. That's not to say Boeing have been absent. Boeing have themselves announced over 100 orders. And I think in terms of the aircraft that Boeing have sold, they seem to have captured more of what we'd call the wide-body market. And, you know, their sales have been in the billions of dollars as well. But it's a fraction of what Airbus has announced so far at the show.
I mean, it's incredible when you look at total numbers, though, because, yes, you have all of these, you know, A320neo orders, which are going to India and to AirAsia. Then you have Hong Kong Airlines, announcing that they're buying the latest stretch version of the 747. And then you've got Europe and you have, Scandinavian finally buying some new short-haul aircraft. Not a lot of interesting news really coming out of the United States. I mean, it's incredible how I mean, really, almost all of the eggs are primarily in an Asian, and as you said at the top, also a Latin American basket.
I think there was one particular order from the US, from Republic, which was for some of the Airbus aircraft, and that was an interesting one because they've also ordered the C series, which is Bombardier's competitor that is encroaching upon the Airbus space. In terms of other interest in the States, that's mainly been from the leasing companies. So we've had Air Lease Corporation, we've had CIT, we've had GECAS, some of the familiar names in the aircraft leasing market. They've been placing orders, but again, obviously, they will be leasing those out, not just to the U.S. market, but into Asia and Europe, etc. But yes, the U.S. has been relatively quiet, or the North American market has been relatively quiet this time around, but that's probably not too surprising, bearing in mind where all the traffic growth is, where the GDP growth is. It's all pretty much Asia-driven and emerging markets.
I mean, you mentioned Bombardier. They announced some orders for their C series, which, you know, is seen as something of a challenger to shake things up in the narrow body market against both Airbus and Boeing. Was that important for them? And do you think that, yeah, you know, if you're the CEO of Boeing, you know, or Airbus, are you particularly concerned by what, you know, the likes of Bombardier, Embraer, and, you know, and we also, you know, saw a little tie up between Boeing and Mitsubishi as well. Is that interesting? And do Brazil, Canada, Japan, do they start to become players a little bit more than they have been in the past in this larger sector?
As you mentioned, Bombardier, Embraer, Mitsubishi in Japan, and we also have other entities. We now have Comac in China, who are encroaching upon the Airbus and Boeing space, and we have the Russians with the Sukhoi Superjet and the Aircut MS-21. These are all models which are in the larger regional sector or perhaps the smaller end of the narrow-body sector as well. And yes, they are encroaching upon what Airbus and Boeing would have felt was their space. Airbus has already responded, as we've just talked about, in terms of the A320neo, in terms of they're adopting the same engines that these new technology airplanes are delivering as well. Boeing's response is yet to come, although what Boeing has done is they're increasing production of their already successful 737 model. So they're making capacity available to the market for those people who wish to carry on buying Boeing. So yes, I think Airbus and Boeing are responding in their own ways. And it's going to get quite exciting, I think, for the traveling public in terms of the options out there going forward.
So all in, do you think, you know, despite all of the, you know, the doom and gloom that you hear when, you know, you know, certainly airlines, you know, issue profit forecasts or earnings forecasts. And, you know, we saw Qantas, you know, deliver some decent numbers in part thanks to their settlement with Rolls-Royce. Was it a good Paris, a mediocre Paris, or far better than anyone would have expected?
I think it's probably been a far more exciting Paris than people had expected. I mean, the number of orders that have come through, I mean, we're talking of over 1,000 airplanes altogether, you know. And I think just in Airbus's total, on its own, I think they're looking at like $70 billion worth of orders and commitments. And, you know, when you see those kind of figures, you can see that we're in that part of the curve where things are improving again. I think the important thing for the airlines is they need the most fuel-efficient aircraft out there. We've seen whenever IATA produces its forecast for the airline profits for the year, if we just have a dollar shift in the price of oil in terms of per barrel, you know, it has a major impact on the profitability of airlines. And so the airlines need to make sure they have the right aircraft going forward. So they've been busy ordering airplanes. Now, I mean, a lot of these aircraft that have been ordered in the past week, you know, these are for delivery from 2015 onwards. And so a lot of the aircraft that are due for delivery in the next few years, that they've already been ordered, and these are sort of filling the spaces and everyone's positioning to make sure they've got access to the right aircraft as things go forward. I mean, I don't think anyone's expecting fuel price to come down particularly far. I think everyone's expecting long term for the fuel prices to increase. And so the airlines need to have the right aircraft for that market going forward.
Eddie Pienzek from Ascend, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly in London and Samaritz. We're back after this.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for culture with me. That's what it says in the script, by the way. I'd like to point out. Sounds rather big-headed, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Shall I introduce myself? Maybe you'd like to, Andrew.
This is back to you kind of doing the show solo.
Back and out to me, please.
This is Rob.
That's when the cutback's called, Andrew.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just going to be a solo presenter every week.
It's going to be me in a yogurt pot and a piece of string. So this week, we've got something rather mellifluous. The Webb Sisters, singing a song called Savages. Guess where they're from. We'll hit play. We'll get Sharpie to hit play, and then you have to guess where they're from.
Okay. Didn't you hear me hitting the buzzer? I was hitting the buzzer. I was trying to find a cowbell here. I guessed it in the first 3 seconds.
Oh no, where?
They're from Ireland.
That sounded when I. Andrew, you go.
Well, are they from Ireland? He's not right. Oh, good. He's not right. I was going to say Sweden.
No. Well, I thought they sounded incredibly California. They sounded very Fleetwood Mac to me. They sounded very Stevie Nicks era.
I thought they sounded very Cranberries.
Oh, God. Well, that's the worst quiz that I've ever come up with.
No, because then I was going the same direction as Andrew, and then I thought they sounded very Cardigans, because it was it sounded a bit Love Fool at one moment.
Well, they're from Kent. That was going to be my
Kent.
Kent. That was my reveal, because they don't sound like they're from Kent, do they?
The Web Sisters.
They sound like they should be drinking cider.
Oh. Sounds like a ladies' cooperative making websites.
Just relax, okay. Do you not like the sound of that, though? I thought it was rather brilliant.
I love the sound.
It's really very, very cool. That's someone we should get in here.
Yeah.
When this gets bigger and better.
Because they might go worldwide, I hear, with the web.
Exactly.
That's not too bad. That's one of my better
ones. Rob, we haven't had one of those in a while, have we?
That's absolutely brilliant. He had that written on his hand. He wrote that on his hand in the taxi on the way here. I saw him. It's a while since you've done a Google pun, isn't it, Andrew?
We've had a very, very tough week in the office because we've been doing iPod jockey, where people put their iPods on until they get either turfed off or, in my case, mainly get embarrassed because something's coming on. So it's when you're on the phone and you can see something coming up on the iPod that you know, oh my God, people are going to really judge me for this coming up. So I did have to kind of pounce on it when Justin Timberlake came on earlier today. So me and Rob have been having a culture editor's kind of, I've been like the culture editor in learning in the background.
It's sort of iPod rodeo rather than iPod jockey. That makes it sound unnecessarily rude.
Wait a second. Culture editor in learning. How about culture editor in training?
I've lost all power of speech. It was Rob that was out late last night, not me. And I've taken it on by osmosis.
I've tidied up my act since I got in here.
I think it's time for a break.
It is. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly from London. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly. Next week, the inaugural Book Illustration Awards will take place here in London, designed to celebrate traditional illustration and to emphasise the importance of illustration on our experience and pleasure of reading. But at a time when e-books cause an ever-growing threat to their paper counterparts, we wanted to ask what the future might hold for book illustration. Joining us now in the studio is Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer-Powell. Welcome to the radio, Rich.
Hello.
What's it like? What's it like being in here? You're the sort of the engine room, the powerhouse, and the creative powerhouse of the magazine. What's it like to slum it in the radio studio?
It's quite interesting, actually. The last time I was here was when we were actually doing the first ever one, when we were designing the mic flashes and working out how it would look on web and how we'd do the ads. But you realise that's quite a long time ago. So.
But hold on, your lovely mic flashes have survived.
Okay.
They're still here.
Only just. I think I need to have a word to the team. They need to be a little bit refreshed, I think.
Repaint.
They're a little bit, daggy now.
I think what I hear reverbing on the mountain walls is that Rich wants to do a total overhaul, guys.
Yeah, he's quite keen on rethinks.
Oh, yeah, rethinks and redesigns. That's my summer schedule.
Yeah. Whoops, that was the email that got away. Anyway, back to illustration. We talked about in the intro about it being a possibly dying art form because of e-books. What is that scaremongering, or do you see that? I mean, you're commissioning illustrators a lot of the time. Is that something you see?
I don't think so. I think that would only occur if we end up with the death of print, and I think we won't end up with the death of print. I just think print will become more beautiful, more exclusive. It will be a higher-end medium, and as long as that happens, then I think we'll still have very good illustration and people will still invest in print. I think what might happen is that illustrators may end up being able to do two things. They may end up having to be able to illustrate digitally and then also maybe animate, which is something we've seen more and more when we look at illustrators' websites, is that there's two or three films in there as well. And with digital books, there's probably room for animation in there as well. So I wonder if that may be something that we might see happening.
In terms of animation, that's sort of interesting. Do you think that cheapens the art of illustration, having to do it in a slightly different way? Do you appreciate it in its purest form, the way that you normally commission it? Or do you just see it as a necessary changing of the skills?
I just think computers have just changed, just changed the skill set, and many programs you can kind of do, they work in very similar ways. So vector-based graphics or illustration, lots of animation is using the same tools, so it's just a natural step to do that. But I think what it might do is it might cheapen animation, because what you'll end up with is lots of people that aren't quite good at animation or have been taught to do animation that end up doing it.
Rich, did you just use the word vector?
I did, yes.
He did one with his fingers at me. Viva Vector.
What's been happening since I've been out of the office?
I was on the Sci-Fi channel last night and someone dropped it in and... I googled it, and I think you'll find it's legit, so we can keep that in, don't worry.
Okay, fine.
Tyler, I wanted to ask you about, I mean, obviously, illustrations have been, since the beginning of Monocle and since before it, and a lot of projects in the past as well, illustrations have always been a key part of your sort of favoured aesthetic. Do you see it as something that's sort of threatened by e-books and the like?
I'm not sure if it's so much e-books, but I go back to Rich's point. I think we're always... I wouldn't say laboring over the issue, but it certainly, maybe we're upping the hunt to find, I think, true craftspeople. And, you know, I'm always asking Rich or Poppy, you know, when, you know, a new illustrator's book, you know, is sent my way or I'm looking at a link. And I'm always asking, you know, okay, did they really do this by hand, i.e., you know, not just fingers, you know, on keyboard or, you know, or just using a mouse, but was there an easel involved and was there canvas or was there, you know, a pencil and ink, et cetera? And I guess in the same way that, you know, Rich sort of talks about this potential divide between, you know, what will be the digital world and what will be this premium world of print, I would almost sort of say that we tend to, or at least I tend to think that we also commission people, you know, who can still give us that texture. And I still feel like I look at work and I think, wow, it's, you know, it's amazing. There's just, it gives it a certain lift off the page when it hasn't been done in a digital environment. I don't know if you think that's fair, Rich, or not.
No, absolutely. And I think you can tell straight away when something's been done digitally and when something's been done, you know, by hand. And it's interesting that over the last 10 years, there's been a sort of a shift from people doing digital work, and there's been a return to craft, a return to using hand-cut paper, to doing woodcuts, to doing mixed media. And these awards are also about original artwork, and all six of those finalists are all primarily painters or mixed media. So it's interesting that we're now getting this, you know, a lot of online books and magazines now are the new, you know, the new iTunes store, and yet illustrators are tending to go back to a much more paper craft and shoot, you know, the final result. So they're kind of, the two things are kind of going against each other in a way.
I was just going to ask you something, which is interesting when we do stories and also when you see in books, you know, and I was going to ask Rich, which is, you know, for example, in this issue we've done 50 Things to Improve Your Life, and we chose to go down a completely illustrated route, everything illustrated by the one illustrator. When you're looking at the magazine and when you're thinking about what should be shot and what should be photo and what should be illustration, for you, what's the trick that illustration can do in a way that photography can't do?
Well, I think they can just kind of add a little bit of life and fantasy sometimes. And especially when at Monocle, when you're trying to cover 50 things, to do that photographically is quite a big ask. But also, it's quite nice to have a very graphic, consistent feel to it. And that's where an illustrator's one hand can do that. So I think that kind of makes this whole story stronger. It acts as a single, you know, single unit in that sense.
I wanted to ask, it's sort of a bit of an old sort of magazine cliche about the sort of war between words and pictures. We'll put a sound effect in after that, obviously. That'll come in later. But it is always one of those things. And it's funny that these are the inaugural book illustration awards that set up this discussion. It seems like a sort of strange idea. It's almost as if it's something that's only just sort of happened. But I wonder about the process, whether it's actually genuinely a different process to illustrate for digital as opposed to designing for analog or paper, as it is.
Wait a second, Robert. I actually know what Rich's first shot across the bow is like in that war. And it's when he's it's very simple. It's like when he's run out of ideas and he can only get a spot illustrated, he's just like, Tyler, Rob, Andrew, it's going to be 900 words. If he finds someone good, you get a caption. That's it. I mean, that's how the battle goes, gentlemen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, you know, you do pay me to try and make things look good. So if it looks good, forget the words.
No, I wonder if there is, like, you know, if there is a sort of fetishization.
That was, you try again.
Whether book illustration is becoming a fetish. Let me say. Where is it actually should be? Where, you know, it's a perfectly legitimate part of novels, and it's a perfectly, you know, legitimate part. Graphic novels are becoming increasingly important and taken increasingly seriously. Whether this should be, you know, a growing thing rather than something that's diminishing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it should be. Going back to the other point you said about the digital illustrators work differently to sort of handcrafted illustrators. Again, we're starting to see that people that work digitally are doing pencil sketches first. We're getting a lot of work through that is crafted. It's just then the final medium. is digital. And I think those are the people that are the more successful digital illustrators. And I think what the problem was, there was a problem, you know, probably 6 or 7 years ago, is that too many people thought they were an illustrator because they could use a few tools in, you know, Adobe Illustrator. And then you got a lot of bad work.
Rich, what would you call it? You call that devectorization?
Yeah, devectorization with a sort of polar subcore.
Wow. I can't wait for... this is the only first radio show I've ever seen that's going to have asterisks.
No, we can't have them because they're on wallpaper.
Exactly. But, and do you, I mean, obviously as well, when you, when you're the creative director of a magazine, which is, we can safely say, certainly relied upon to provide inspiration for a few other publications. do you get a sense of satisfaction at that, the style of illustrations you see? Maybe it's a photograph with bullet points coming off it, etc. The way that the magazines are designed and the illustration, is that flattering or is that irritating?
It's just part and parcel for it, unfortunately. And yet it is irritating because I always get turned off when an illustrator that we've found ends up in another publication. And you just can't help but not want to commission them again, which is a real shame. So we try and keep them to ourselves, but you can't always do that. But what is nice about, you know, the defining a look is just having a long-term relationship with illustrators and photographers for that matter. But, you know, some of our illustrators have been in from, you know, issue one and they're still going today. And I think they help as much as typefaces and writing style, colours, all those things. It just helps define the look and feel of the mag.
And Rich, do you think that there's kind of hubs of great illustration at the moment? I know that we get lots of things in from Japan, for example, and I see one of the shortlisted artists is Korean in these illustration awards. Are you finding that when you look around the world that there are consistently kind of centres of excellence that come up again and again?
Well, for our style, for Monocle style, it's Japan is big, as it is lots of other things for us. But yeah, there is a lot of creative talent there in illustration. But more so, a trend I would say is it's more the age of illustrators. A lot of our illustrators are slightly old school. Not many are young, fresh grads. A lot of them have been around for a while and have been doing, you know, old techniques. And they're not particularly trendy, but they've got a style, you know, a craft that we admire. And we commission them for that sort of purpose.
Just like us.
Just like that.
Well, I love the
fact that what
I love the fact that one of our guys is literally sits on an island and is an engraver of postage stamps most of the time, apart from the work he does for us, which is you know, as craft based as you can get.
Yeah, and you know, no one else would be commissioning him. They'll look at that work and think, and you know, who's this old duffer that's just doing, you know, seabird illustrations, you know, week after week. But actually, if you look at his technique, it's fantastic, and if you give him a style leader to do, he does a brilliant job.
I like the idea we should always just commission poets to kind of do expos in that case, you know.
Rich, I was also going to ask as well, do you think that, you know, we've been able to somehow protect our stable of illustrators, you know, in part because we don't exactly make it easy for ourselves. We make it very difficult for others. Dealing with someone like Gaku Nakagawa in Kyoto, who is a monk, I could imagine that, you know, it wouldn't be so easy for The Guardian or The New York Times to work with him.
No, I think I agree. And we don't tell our illustrators not to work for anyone else, but we try and keep them so busy that they haven't got the time to work for anyone else. And we also dangle carrots and allow them to do nice big projects online and posters. And I think no one else is offering that out there at the moment. So I think with them, they're fairly safe at the moment.
Well, that's good. I hope they're listening to that. I hope they can't use that in a court of law.
Because I was often looking across at Richard's desk. What's he doing? Oh, he's dangling his carrot.
Yeah, he's dangling his carrot. That's what he is. On that note.
Oh, dear.
Richard Vector Powell, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly in London, where it's time for this week's monologue with Aisha Spears.
There are worse ways to spend the last 2 weeks of June than in Milan and Paris, zipping between shows and showrooms to preview the men's fashion collections for next spring. And so far this year, the weather has been on our side. Although, as I was passing through the sun-drenched piazza in front of Milan's Duomo, it dawned on me that the hundreds of international press, buyers and designers who are in town for only a few days were no doubt too busy to soak up the sights surrounding them. Schedules are tight during any fashion week, and the 4-day-long calendar for Milan's men's shows is no exception. Business has to be done. Visitors fly in from as far away as Korea, Australia and Brazil for the biannual event. Buyers make orders that allow labels to go into production with their new designs, and press C previews that help plan out their editorial coverage for the upcoming season. However, with so many aesthetes in town, surely there's a way to squeeze in some cultural appreciation that's not related to the latest print on a Piombo jacket or the newest colour of a Todd's loafer. Why don't we take a little bit more notice of the addresses printed on the glossy embossed show invitations that are delivered to our hotels? Held on the first day, Burberry's catwalk show is at number 16 Corso Venezia, just northeast of Milan Centre. Along with everyone else, I ran in to take my seat and await the spectacle, ignoring the impressive three-story facade of the Palazzo Serbelloni, in which Burberry had set up their tent. On a street renowned for its parade of palazzi, the building was once home to the Serbelloni family, who were celebrated for their military prowess. Originally built in the 15th century, the palace was redesigned 300 years later to accommodate the large entertaining rooms that had become fashionable in Milan at the time. The next day, Ferragamo shows in the Palazzo Mezzanotte, a neoclassical structure built in the 1920s to house the Borsa Italiana, Italy's main stock exchange. At the time of its opening, the Palazzo Mezzanotte was one of the most advanced buildings in Italy, featuring air conditioning and a huge electronic display showing changing stock prices in real time. I realise how easy it was to ignore spaces like the beautiful tree-filled courtyard at Trissardi's offices on Via Duse, or the painted ceilings of the rooms on Via Morone in which Piombo showed. Perhaps tailoring brand Caruso offered the perfect solution. Their new showroom on Via Monte Napoleone is not only a bright space to preview the collection in, but also one to see a side of Milan rarely accessible to those passing through for business. As we sat on their terrace, covered in ivy and strawberry plant, eating prosciutto and drinking sparkling wine, we took note of the unique planted rooftops of the city skyline and forgot the busy street below. Even within a busy schedule, more brands should take advantage of their beautiful locations. Surely, it would encourage visitors to come back more often than just twice a year. For Monocle, I'm Aisha Spears.
That was our Aisha Spears from our New York bureau. And that's just about all we've got time for this week. Outro chat, chaps? Fancy one of those?
Yeah, let's have a little bit of a chat before we go.
Let's have one of those, a little cosy part. Rich is still here.
Rich, you still in the studio?
I'm still here, yeah.
Rich, I'm actually looking at some of the local newspapers, because Radio Engadine, where I am stationed at the moment, is owned by one of the newspaper groups, the Die Südostschweiz, which is, surprisingly, it's the newspaper of Southeast Switzerland. And
I thought you were going to say something really then.
So I've got there's maybe a little bit of redesign work that you could do. I've also got the Engadiner Post, which is this would be a tricky one for you, Rich, because it's they lay it out both in German and Romansh. So some stories appear in German and some are in Romansh.
And what's the big story in the valley today?
Well, the big story in the valley today is that National Park Region wird auch zur Gesundheitsregion, and that's
I was worried about that.
Yeah, I hate it when they misspell it as well.
And then the big story in Die Südostschweiz is they're obviously worried about migrants from North Africa, of course, coming into Graubünden.
Two of them.
They're talking big numbers, 450 people. Okay. But they've already mobilized a mothballed military base, so they've got a place to
attack them or help them.
I think the word would be process them.
Okay.
To keep their clothes nice and fresh, I think.
Or to host them, something like that. Good. They're also going to there's a 2025 plan for the Suvretta House Hotel, which is going to involve a 300 million franc investment. And there was another good story in here. Where did it go? Oh, Rob, actually, this is one for you. In the Engadiner Post, I'm having to switch back and forth between newspapers here. It's the jazz festival that's coming up.
Oh, yeah, the good old jazz festival, like that.
Yeah, so Till Brunner is going to be playing the Manhattan Transfer.
Manhattan Transfer?
Yeah.
I like that. You're going to stay around for that, aren't you?
Ahmad Jamal. It starts the 14th of July. Andrew, can I stay here till then?
You can stay there till then. No animal stories. No no cows stuck up mountains.
No cows stuck up mountains. Definitely not. No, nothing like that.
Tyler, when you say the big story, are you referring to type? Point size there, or yeah. I'm just thinking redesign because you started talking to me about that.
Yeah, well, I'm actually not sure what they're using. There's, I think it could be maybe it's Switzerland. It could be Universe. That they mix for all headlines. And this is just take this tip. In the Engadiner Post, they're using a sans serif quite handsomely as well. But in the Südostschweiz, there's a little bit of sans serif, but they might be taking a few design cues from you as well. But I don't think you could design a weather page like they do, Rich.
No.
No.
I'll expect to see a tear sheet on my desk, no doubt, sometime soon.
I'm gonna beam it to you. I'm actually gonna vector it off the top of Pizbween and hope it'll land on your desk.
That was brilliant. That really genuinely did turn into sort of an editorial meeting there, didn't it?
That's exactly what they sound like.
You're listening to Newsnacht.
I think we'll do this. This worked so well with Radio Engadina that maybe we'll do the program again just like this next week, because I have another week of physiotherapy. I got to use the Swiss ball today in physio.
Come on, Andrew. This is one for you.
No, I know that was me. I resisted. There's no ball jokes for me.
Teed up like a golf ball for you, Andrew. I can't believe you missed the shot there.
We'll just leave it there. That's all for edition 105 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show is produced by Alex Mills. Our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here. Well, there, actually, at the Sound Company in London. And I want to say a huge thank you to Andre here at Radio Engadina for hosting us here in Samaden.
And if you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then please drop us a note at weekly@monocle.com. And remember to catch up with us daily via our Monocle on our website. But for now, from London, I'm Robert Bound.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Richard Spencer-Powell.
And from St Moritz, I'm Tyler Brulé of Samaden. More next week. Goodbye.